Welcome to the Smart Family Podcast, where we want to help you love being home. Here are your hosts, Dr. Rob Meter and Tony Newhoff.
Hi there, and welcome to the Smart Family Podcast. We are so thrilled that you've joined us. We've got a special episode in store for you today. Dr. Mona Delahook is a guest we featured about a year ago now. I believe it was March 3rd, 2021. And to date, she is the most downloaded episode that we've had so far. Mm-hmm. We love this episode because Mona takes on that problem of a child having tantrums, or your child who has has blowouts, and as a parent, you want to help, but you're sort of at a loss as to how to help. She has dedicated her professional career to getting underneath the cause and really getting a much better, clearer understanding of where that behavior is coming from, to guide us parents on how we respond. So, Rob, I would love to hear your comments, because I'm sure you hear about this a lot in your practice.
Absolutely, Tony, all the time. And I recommend Mona's book, Beyond Behaviors, quite frequently to the parents that I talk to. I use her model of the tip of the iceberg, where, you know, the behavior is really just a communication of something else going on beneath the surface. And that analogy, I think, really resonates with a lot of parents. And it's what we talk about in the episode today, and which is why I think was so popular. I think a lot of parents just realize, okay, this is really practical stuff that makes a lot of sense. So I'm glad that she's going to be on the podcast again, for those that may have missed it the first time around or just want to hear this practical advice again. And just a little note as well, that for those that are listening to this episode before April the 14th, 2022, I'm actually doing a conference with Mona for the Seasons Center for Grieving Children in Barrie. So if you just go to grievingchildren.com, and you'll find information there for the education day, which includes a parents for sessions in the evening. And so it's free. And so if you want to hear Mona there, please do look that up and attend that education day. She's going to be talking about some new work that she has done and this very topic as well. So I'm glad that Mona is joining us today.
Rob, I really want to make sure our parents actually catch that website. Did you say grievingcenter.com?
Grievingchildren.com.
Grievingchildren.com. Okay, thank you. Grievingchildren.com is the place where you can go and sign up for this webinar, I guess, on April 14th, 2022. It sounds like it's going to be fantastic, because between you and Mona, and I believe there's another guest as well.
Yeah, Stephen Porges as well. So okay. He's there as well, and he's well known for his work on the polyvagal theory, which is often another way to look at stress and trauma and how we respond to that. So also very, very exciting.
Wow. Well, such an amazing free opportunity. So mm-hmm. I hope if you're listening before April 14th and you have young children or children at home, hop over and sign up for that webinar. So just to introduce our guest, Dr. Mona Delahook, she is a clinical psychologist who has done decades of research and work in the area of translating neuroscience research into practical tools for parents. She delves into polyvagal theory and what is actually causing these disruptions in behavior to help parents and people who work with kids to get beneath the surface, to really understand where the behavior is coming from so that we can respond and support children in meaningful ways. She lives in the LA area, and she is so active on social media. She blogs, she gives trainings, and leads an online community. So Dr. Mona Delahook is just a joy to have an interview with, and I'm happy to lead us into that conversation now.
Thank you so much for joining us on our podcast today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Now, are you located in California? Is that where you are? this evening?
I am located in Los Angeles County, and my offices are about 20 minutes from downtown Los Angeles.
Okay, great. Well, we're on opposite coasts, but I think we have common interests. We love to help families and kids. And in fact, I found out about you from a patient of mine who had read your book and recommended it. And I said, I got to read that book because it sounds a lot like the lines of what I'm doing and telling parents here. So, and when I read it, I said, yes, we should have Mona on our podcast. So thanks so much for joining us today.
Awesome.
And really to talk about kids' behavior. And, you know, usually that comes around that discussion when we talk about kids misbehaving or not behaving. And, you know, when we see a child misbehaving, Mona, a number of thoughts might go through our head. For example, some of us might think that the child is attention seeking or maybe in a power struggle, you know, with the parent or pushing some buttons. Sometimes we think parents aren't being tough enough or they're being too tough. You know, all these thoughts go through our head. When you see a child acting out or misbehaving, what are you seeing as a child psychologist?
As Mona Delahook child psychologist, not as a typical child psychologist, I'll tell you what I'm seeing. Because I have to tell you that the way I parented myself, my children are older, but the way I parented myself and the way I was trained and the way most mental health professionals and psychologists are trained today is to see behavior, just as you said, Dr. Rob, as a child maybe seeking negative attention or trying to get out of something or being on the receiving end of inconsistent discipline. We have a lot of very strongly held beliefs about what behaviors mean. Mm-hmm. And it's in our culture. It's in the way we think about it. It's almost in our parental DNA to look at behaviors from the surface and to make sure we raise up children well. So having said that, I have a lot of compassion for those of us who believe that. And I just want to say that and the stuff that I'm about to say, self-compassion is my biggest request of all parents. Because we all have regrets and we all are insecure and we all feel like we're being watched all the time and judged. So what I'm about to say, please put your hand over your heart and feel very compassionate of yourself, because what I'm going to talk to you about is kind of not the mainstream yet, but something that I'm super excited about. So to answer your question, when I see a child who is having a behavior, particularly one that's disruptive or what we might consider a misbehavior, I see a child whose body is having an adaptive reaction to a change in what we call their physiological state. In other words, something's happened inside that child's body-brain connection that is requiring them to have a behavior, which is essentially a way we move our body. Something they're saying or doing is trying to help them stay in the game physiologically. And maybe we can unpack that, but it's that when I see a behavior, I see, bring it on. This is great information about what this child needs right now. Instead of, oh no, we have a misbehavior. We better crack down on our discipline. That's not what I see.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and I'll be honest here too. I'll put my hand up right away. As a pediatrician, I mean, first of all, we spend about as much time on the brain and neurology as we do, say, on the kidney, you know, and not a lot of training goes into really understanding children's behavior. And when we do, it's usually on the basis of like, hey, what's the diagnosis here? You know, let's make a diagnosis, you know, what medications might work to combat that, as opposed to what is the child really saying here? You know, this comes up over and over again in our podcasts. It's like, why are we seeing that behavior? You know, why is a child acting out in this way? What are they communicating through their behavior? Is that what you're saying, Mona?
Oh, it's wonderful to hear that you pay attention to that as a pediatrician, because again, the way we are trained in mental health, in child psychology, is to look at it look at a checklist. If a child meets a checklist of symptoms, we think, uh-oh, there's a disorder causing the behavior. But mm-hmm. no, labels don't cause behaviors. Yeah. Adaptive functioning causes behaviors. So here's the deal. It's not that a child is necessarily trying to communicate consciously or intentionally. It's that the child's body is expressing a behavior. Again, say a child's hitting or kicking or spitting. There are different types of behaviors that we'll probably get into. But what I see again is an adaptive response to something inside the child's body. And it's not always a child planning it ahead of time in order to communicate something. There's a difference. And we'll unpack that if you want.
So Mona, maybe a good place to start would be with an analogy that you draw to challenging behaviors like the ones you mentioned, the kicking, the spitting, being the tip of the iceberg. Can you explain what you mean by that analogy?
Well, when I was writing my book, I was trying to think of what's an analogy like that would make sense to people. And around the same time, I had my first visit to Alaska and I saw an iceberg. And then they told us that the big chunk of ice is like 90% bigger underneath. And so the tip is what you see. And I'm like, okay, this is what behaviors are like. Behaviors are like the tip of the iceberg. It's what we see. It's the obvious thing that we see. And for most of us, we use the behavior as the guide, as, okay, we'll just take this behavior and manage the behavior. This is the legacy from something called behavior theory, that behaviors are fair game for us to just work on the surface level. But that's the key. Behaviors as seen by the tip of the iceberg, are only signals. They're signals that something deeper is going on, and that under the waterline, you have all the causes, the triggers, the pieces of functioning, like the body, for example. Mm-hmm. Let's just say, here's one piece under the tip of the iceberg for some children and for some adults, frankly. And that would be the lack of deep sleep cycling. Some children who've had really bad sleep for several days or maybe even more have behavioral outbursts that are really intense. So the behavior in that case, the tip of the iceberg is the child yelling or screaming or trying or taking something from another child, but under the waterline, under that big chunk of ice, is a lack of deep sleep cycling. So there are millions of causes under the surface of what we can't see. And that's where we want to focus our attention to help children.
Right. So you're saying we have to be careful that we don't oversimplify things too much by saying, well, that's behavior is, you know, just from what it looks like on the surface, because behind every story is a very complicated, deeper story that could be a long time in the making, really, right? This is not just an immediate response to an immediate situation. This has been modified by potentially years of experiences.
Beautifully said. Absolutely. From the moment we're born, probably even prenatally, our subconscious memories, our procedural memories, build in these systems that inform our behaviors. So years and years, you're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But now, Mona, you do have, you do mention a lot, a structure or a way of looking at behavior called polyvagal theory. And I have a strange feeling that when I throw that word out there, a lot of parents are going like, "Poly what?" I said the same thing too when I first read about it. But it does represent a nice way of thinking about behaviors, how to escalate and de-escalate, and how, you know, and so you describe it and you use a color-coded system. And I'm wondering, just as a way of background, maybe you can summarize this in a nutshell, exactly what polyvagal theory is and why it applies to what we're talking about today.
Yes. So, right. And to honestly, a lot of people, when you start to talk about neuroscience or polyvagal or autonomic, you know, the autonomic nervous system, it's people's eyes glaze over and they're like, no, don't. And so, and I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm a child psychologist who translates neuroscience. So just let me give you the most basic idea, because once I studied the polyvagal theory, and it's, it was developed by Dr. Stephen Porges, a neuroscientist, psychologist, researcher, very kind man, whom I had the good fortune of meeting through professional channels years ago. Basically, this theory is a way of understanding the nervous system. Okay, we have a nervous system. One of the systems is called the autonomic nervous system, and it kind of is what directs our behaviors, our emotions. It creates the platform for how the information that we get in through our bodies, right, through our senses, how that gets processed from the body to the brain and from the brain back down to the body. It's called bidirectional because, you know, we get information through our or sense systems, and then it comes up to the brain. Then the brain decides, okay, I'm going to send down the instructions. And so when it sends down the instructions, it in this model of functioning, and of course it's a model, it's evolving, right? So, but this model sends instructions down through three main pathway systems that I call pathways, and we name them colors of the nervous system, and they result in predictable behaviors in children and in adults. So if you want me to, I can briefly go over the three main ones.
Yeah, no, that'd be great. Like, because you described a blue, red, and green pathway, and green being the ideal one we'd like to see our kids in. So maybe start by describing that one and kind of go from there.
Yeah, the green is called the social engagement system. And in this theory, it's the when humans feel safe, when we feel like we are calm and not in any sort of threat, think of it as your body kind of having a good homeostasis. You know, you're just feeling just right. And of course, parents love it when their kids are paying attention and following directions and being happy and playing and all that. That's when we're in the green state. The ventral vagal is the technical term pathway of the nervous system, but I call it the green pathway. And this, again, the requirement for the green pathway is that the human body and brain are detecting safety. And that means from the inside of the body and from the outside, from the environment. And the green is it's wonderful. However, we know we're not robots. So nobody's always in the green. Nobody's always calm. If we were, we'd be dead. Because we have to react to threat, right? We have to react to a car that's moving really fast and we have to jump out of the way if the car comes too close. Yep. When we do something like that, we have a system called neuroception that is a subconscious detection of threat and safety. And it directs our nervous system into one of two other pathways. The red pathway, which is known as the sympathetic nervous system, you might know it as the fight or flight system, right? It creates fast movement and action to keep us safe. This is where we might see a child out of the blue hit their sibling or throw a bowl of cereal across the room, right? It looks like it's out of the blue, but it's not. Something has shifted in their nervous system. That's the red pathway. So we all cycle from the green to the red when it's needed. And then the third one is the blue pathway. And that one happens less frequently, fortunately, but we need to be watching out for that. And that is when human beings feel the sense of threat and they start to disconnect and they lose hope. And that's when they kind of can be immobilized. So that's when a child or an adult, you know, these are all human, they're pathways. They're not just for children, can begin to pull away, not talk, not smile, and not interact. If that happens to your child and it lasts for many days or weeks, definitely contact your pediatrician or your or a health provider. But it's if we cycle into these in and out naturally through the day. However, parents don't come to bring their children to me, to see me for the green pathway, right? Mm-hmm. Parents usually contact me if their children are flipping out into the red, the more aggressive, disruptive, what we know as misbehaviors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned a really important thing there about triggers and triggering, because you're saying that all behavior is triggered. Because what we hear a lot is parents saying, it comes out of the blue, comes out of nowhere. Suddenly our kid's throwing, you know, a bowl of cereal across the room, like you just said, or a corn cob across the restaurant, you know, but it comes out of the blue. But what you're saying is that there is actually a trigger for every behavior, or
absolutely. Is it something that's, behaviors do not happen out of the blue. And they also don't happen, even though it feels like it, that our children are trying to make our life miserable and they are out of control and they need more. And they are just, you know, trying to do this because they are bored, you know, well, that might happen. But again, a child launching a corn cob across a restaurant is a child's body who's under stress. And that is such a kind of a nice new way of looking at misbehaviors, because then it requires us to have a whole different pathway of what we do to help the child.
Mm-hmm. And try to understand.
So Mona, you've said, I believe, that children really need to be in that green zone to feel safe if they're going to explore their world and learn. And yet we know that children can end up in the red zone or in the blue zone. How is it that we can help children transition if you do notice, like, what are the signs of a child being in the red zone and needing to be calmed down or somehow transitioned into the green state so that they can learn?
Right. Well, we really need to become kind of detectives about autonomic state, about our child's pathways. And many parents will know, like you'll get a sense. Sometimes parents have told me that when their child wakes up in the morning, they can look at them and they know this child is on edge. There's, you know, something, this is going to be a fun morning, right? Something, and maybe the child didn't sleep well at night. Maybe the child is incubating a virus. Maybe the child has a molar coming in. Or maybe the child is dealing with something, that is a scary memory for them. Maybe something happened at school or preschool. So we want to observe the signs on a child's body. And ideally, we don't want to wait till they've thrown the punch. We want to look at the stress in the body. And I have a checklist, you know, that we look at their features of the face, the eyes. Normally when you have a relaxed face, your child is smiling. They're not tense or clenched. Their eyes aren't big and darting around the room. You know, there's a look on the face that actually tells you when a child is starting to feel stressed for most children. Now, some neurodivergent children have a kind of, you can't tell it by a look on the, by a facial expression. That's fine. Then you might go to something else, their posture. Are they really like this? Are they clenched with their shoulders up and their fists drawn? The other feature we can look at is tone of voice. So the tone of voice, as Dr. Porges says, is a kind of a polygraph for our autonomic state. So a child who has a very pressured tone of voice, or an adult, if they're starting to yell, scream, if they're starting to use very monotone in their voice, look for voice shifts. These are some really great signs we can read on our on the child's body to say, uh-oh, they're starting to shift from green, calm, to red, activated.
Yeah.
And it's going to be different for each child, of course.
But I guess that requires us to be really attuned to our kids, right? To kind of see these little subtle things that maybe only you as a parent can really get to know. I mean, these are the unique things about your child. This is their signature in a way.
Yes.
Of something's up.
Yes, this is their signature. And every child is the same. I know for my own three kids, there were different triggers for each one. And they had it in their body. They showed it in different ways. One of my children who was very sensitive and who was very, just very, very zen and sweet and didn't give me much information on her body because she always seemed okay, ended up having severe gastrointestinal issues because it was inside of her and her signals were very subtle. And I wish I would have had someone, because this was before my training in polyvagal, I wish I would have had her pediatrician or anyone telling me, hey, let's look at the stress because you know what? There are some symptoms here in her body that don't make sense. Yeah. And if I would have known, I would have seen those. If I would have looked closely, which my field of psychology still doesn't have us looking at the body. And I don't think the field of pediatrics has us really looking at the child's autonomic state. So this is why I train and talk about this cross-disciplinary necessity.
Yeah. No, I agree with you, Nick. We need to take a holistic approach to seeing a kid's behavior, right? And I mean, you just mentioned the gastrointestinal symptoms. I mean, that is so common in kids who are under stress or feeling anxious, often gets misdiagnosed as many other things when really we haven't focused on the autonomic nervous system as being
That's right.
underneath all of that.
You're so right. You're so right, Dr. Rob, because I understand it's necessary to get things checked out with a GI specialist, but I've had so many children come into my practice who've had these procedures that they probably didn't have to have and going into a GI and they're saying everything's fine. And then had we looked more closely in the beginning at the stress, that could have saved money, and also saved stress of the child having to go visit another strange doctor that they didn't need to see.
No, absolutely. You mentioned top down and bottom up. I mean, as two ways of thinking about behaviors as well. What's the distinction there? Why is it called? What's the directions all about in that description?
Well, we generally think of all behaviors as top down, and that is on purpose, intentional, or volitional. Even little two-year-olds. So, you know, most two-year-olds can talk and they can walk and it seems like they can follow a one-step direction. You know, they can grab their shoes or, you know, hand you things and they can name colors. And so we think that that means that they're in control of their emotions and behaviors, which is top down, right?
Mm-hmm.
Self-control. It's known in the literature as conscious effortful control, conscious control, self-control, impulse control. That's top down is when you can control your behaviors and your emotions. Two-year-olds don't have top-down control.
Mm-hmm.
Two-year-olds are bottom up. Bottom up is pretty much instinctual, adaptive to your nervous system, and it's without conscious thought. And I'm, again, introducing this idea that parents should ask, is this behavior top down or bottom up? If it's adaptive and instinctual, it's reflexive. That's when a sibling gets hit or a child spits or kicks. That's instinctual behavior. The child is doing it in a subconscious defense and not as a brat or as a little troublemaker, particularly in our birth to five, you know, our 2 to 5 year olds. But let's remember that conscious control starts at 3.5 to 4 and it's continuing now, we know, until the mid 20s.
Mm-hmm.
So it's under construction. So top down means effortful, self-regulated and I'm doing this on purpose. And of course, children will do that. Like, you know, here's an example of top-down in a three-year-old. They may walk into the kitchen when mommy's not looking and take a cookie that they're not supposed to take and run away and eat it in their closet. Okay, that's top-down. They did it on purpose. But then 10 minutes later, that same three-year-old might throw a heavy toy at their baby brother because they are at the end of their rope. It's time for a nap and they can't control themselves anymore. That's bottom up.
Right. Right. So is top down the preferred behavior direction
I think we have to really not think of top down as the ultimate, and rather that top down control is an emerging neurodevelopmental capacity, an emerging neurodevelopmental skill that little people grow year by year. And we have to be very patient in understanding that top-down control isn't, we worship it too much. I see this in preschools all the time. And even in kindergartens, when teachers are saying, okay, I'll give you a reward if you sit still. And then you've got half the kids in the class can't keep their body still yet because they're still body up, bottom up. And then they feel bad about themselves. And then the rest of the students and the parents who find out that the child got a, you know, mark on their chart for not being still. We need to readjust our understanding of behaviors to not expect too much too soon. Mm-hmm. And this is the main problem we are having, particularly for our vulnerable populations of children. Our neurodivergent children, our children who have experienced trauma or toxic stress, and our children who are simply taking longer to develop top-down control.
I would imagine that trauma or a toxic experience in childhood would impact children as far as the bottom-up kinds of behaviors. How exactly does that work?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked, Tony, because it's a direct result. Our ability to develop our executive function, right? To become that good executive, to make good decisions, to know that what I do today is going to impact my life tomorrow or the next minute even, is developed in one way. And that is through what we call co-regulatory relationships, safe, warm, nurturing relationships that are predictable. And so if that gets thrown off for a child, and again, sometimes it's to no fault of the parent. If the parent has a physical illness, for example, I've had some children whose parents have had to be in the hospital for extended periods of time. And so, and then there, it's hard, there's stress, right? And so that child we expect that child to regress behaviorally because their stabilizer, their parent isn't there. So the way we develop self-regulation is another whole aspect that's a little different than self-control, but regulating our body states happens through co-regulation. And that is through warm, loving parents who will give us boundaries, let us know what's okay to do, what's not okay to do, and be there for us emotionally when we're scared, most of all. And when that gets thrown off a target, and that can happen through, you know, so many different life circumstances, but it can happen for parents who are splitting up, for example. And if a child witnesses high stress or parents fighting with each other, for example, all these things can increase the child's inner stress. And then if the parent doesn't come and help repair that so that the child feels safe again, we can have a delay in this self-regulation and this ability to have top-down behaviors. So that's why we really want to find our vulnerable children early and let parents know that it really matters what your child sees, what your child witnesses, and the school atmosphere your child's in. If you're in a school that uses corporal punishment, for example, there are some states in the US that does, speak up. Parents are rising up and saying, like, if they do weird things to children, like make them stand in the back of the classroom by themselves, that can be toxic stress for the other kids in the class too. So I'm really calling that out as a psychologist, because I think it's time that we really update some of our notions about how we manage behaviors. And some of our approaches can make children have more trauma. Timeout rooms for very vulnerable children. So I've worked with children over times who are from foster homes and they are acting out at school. The teachers think it's purposeful misbehavior. The school has a timeout area. The child's always sent to the timeout area. But a human who is in the fight or flight and having a lot of these disruptive behaviors needs the opposite of a timeout. They need another adult coming alongside them and saying, oh, my dear child, this is hard. It looks like something's hard for you right now. Can I sit with you? Can I help you? It's just turning the tables on a lot of our notions of what behaviors mean.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, I think you're talking about the concept there of what Dan Siegel might call connect and then redirect. You know, you got to respond emotionally to a child before you can even hope to, you know, help them.
Yes.
And you got to put them in that place of safety. I mean, it sounds like a kid who lives in chronic fear of being embarrassed or humiliated or hurt physically, heaven forbid, that brain is not going to be in any state to learn new things or to understand what's going on. That sounds like we're not keeping that kid in the green zone at all.
At all. Exactly. We have good intentions. We're trying to teach the child a lesson. Okay, so let's just say that those schools or those teachers and those parents of us that, including myself, before I studied this, would believe that we are teaching this child a lesson. So they have to learn that if they do X, we are going to do Y. But here's the shift. It's not just A and B. It's A, the child does something, and then in the middle of this is the child's physiological state causing the behavior. So when you get to the cause of the behavior, which is generally a child's overactive red pathway, right? They're feeling like they're in the fight or flight. And you work at that level, you don't even have to redirect. The social engagement system kicks in and the child naturally wants to cooperate. It's beautiful. It works. It works so much better than typical or traditional, I should say, maybe more traditional approaches, which tell parents and teachers, if you're not consistent in your discipline, your child's going to turn out to be more wild, essentially. It's not true.
So, Mona, when you talk about needing a warm, affectionate, responsive presence when a child is upset or maybe in the red zone and maybe has acted out, it may be counterintuitive for us to think of responding by maybe playing with the child. But I think that sometimes what it sounds like you're saying is that there is more of a role for play, maybe even parents playing with their kids, than we might have thought.
Well, as it turns out, play is the best neural exercise in the world. There's a lot of research coming out about the benefits of play. In fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics this past year sent out a letter to pediatricians asking them to prescribe play to all their patients, because their studies found so many health benefits across categories. Mm-hmm. But let me just say, let me first address the first part of your question, which I think is an important one. And I'm not suggesting that if a child does a behavior that is not in keeping with your family values on what a child should or should not do, or if they do something that hurts someone, that we do, I think, at least in my culture and my parenting value, would be to not allow a child to hurt themselves or anybody else, and to set a nice boundary, to say, yeah, honey, that's, you know, that's not acceptable, if they can even hear you say that. So I'm suggesting that we don't have to give up our authority, our role essentially as trainers and teachers of our children. But I'm saying that we, in our mind, when we frame, is this a top-down or is this a bottom-up, it shifts our approach. So if it's bottom-up, if you really feel like something is, something caused it, that you might even put your hand on your child's back, or look to see if they have little sweat on their nose, or touch their hands to see if they're sweaty, you'll know they're activated if you feel those things. And then your approach was like, okay, no, you know, you can't throw that. So we're going to put the plate away right now. We're going to put the food away. Can't do that. But then your next step is to try to see how you can calm that nervous system. And as it turns out, playfulness, and then actual pretend play, there's so many uses for these playful interactions, because you can shift the child from red to green with a single interaction if you know your child. And sometimes it takes a while, but if you know your child, there's some things that you can do. Like I was with a little one-year-old this morning, and you know, I took something away from her that she couldn't play with. It was dangerous, you know, and she started to cry. But I knew that was bottom up. You know, she was fussing and all upset. She was in the red, and I set an appropriate limit. But I know the type of movement she loves. And so I picked her up and I did this soft movement. I put my head here and a head on her, my cheek on her forehead, and I moved sideways, and within a minute she was like kind of drooling and her little body calmed down and we started to play. So it's, you know, that's a one-year-old, but you can think of things for a three-year-old, a five-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 13-year-old. It's all going to look different, right? Mm-hmm. It's all going to look different, but we can do it as parents. And I like to say that, you know, it is really hard. It sounds kind of counterintuitive, because, again, as parents, and I go from my own experience, I felt like I was doing my duty to be authoritarian and to set limits and to be consistent with my discipline that was drilled into me in graduate school. And so it's doing both. We're not letting go of that, but we're also taking into account the nervous system.
Yeah. And I totally understand and relate to what you're saying, Mona, because, you know, we often parent how we were parented. And I know I have four kids myself. And, you know, I feel myself get triggered sometimes too. There are certain behaviors that for me, for whatever reason, make me feel like I need to do some negative reinforcement or some punishment, because it's really triggering for me. And it must, you know, for example, one thing is when I see my kids disrespecting my wife, for example, that for me just brings up some emotions. And and so, you know, and I feel like some negative reinforcement is called for, you know, but right. What you're saying is like, no, I know that's tempting and you want to do it that way. What should parents do in that moment when they feel something rising up in them saying like, I got to, you know, put the foot down or do some sort of, you know, timeout or punishment of some sort?
Yeah. Oh, it's just like with such compassion for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't think it's an either or. I think we can do both, because you hit interesting that you mentioned the respect button, but that happened to be one of my own too. Like if I saw my child disrespecting me or their dad or saying something, it was like, no, don't talk to me that way. That's not how I'm raising you, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think that we can still say that. We can honor what our values are in our family. We can still. So, but in that situation, like, let's just say a child, like an eight-year-old, for example, yells something in that red pathway. We can, and it'll like, you know, calls their mom a name, right? And it, but they're in the red pathway. And the way we know it is that their face is scrunched up, their heart's beating fast, they are maybe have a tear, they're trying to run away, they're hitting things, they're activated. Mm-hmm. If a child says something in the red pathway, they're likely going to feel really guilty and not mean it, because the red pathway is the defense pathway and it got the best of them. And so what I'm suggesting to parents is if your child says or does something in that fight or flight red pathway, that you understand that their ability for self-control is still developing. Of course, you can say, you know, that's not okay. We don't talk that way to our, you know, we don't talk that way to our mom here. But then you think in your mind, what is driving this behavior? This behavior was a bottom-up reaction, not a top-down. And if it's bottom-up, we go to, again, you can set a nice boundary, but then we go to some sort of activity where we connect and say, wow, that was hard, but you're not alone. And I love you, and I'm here, and we'll get through this together. Mm-hmm. So most children, I believe, don't say things or do things that are really mean or really horrible intentionally. I believe what Ross Green, our colleague Ross Green says, yeah. Children do well when they can. I believe that to be true. And I think we need to think deeper about these, again, this ability to control my voice, my words, my actions. Starts at 3.5 to 4 years old, this intentional control. Once in a while, a child can do it. But every year, and it's going to be different for every child, this maturing executive function takes years to develop. And it's new information our parents didn't have. And it's new information for many of us as parents. And it's going to take a while for us to integrate what it means. So that's why I say, be kind to yourself. Take care of your own nervous system first, because if we act out of our red pathway, that's when we are most likely to do stuff we are going to feel really bad about at night. So the times when I yelled at the top of my voice at my children, or threw, you know, literally kind of threw one of them into the car and felt like, oh, like, how could I have done that? Those are when we are out of control. So we really want to try to stay in control if we can, you know, take a breath, take a second, take 2 seconds. It's often very worth it. And then don't beat yourself up. Mm-hmm. We're human. Parenting is the hardest thing in the world. Yeah. And if you're a parent in this pandemic right now, just please, anything you do is forgivable, you know, and I don't mean that you should do that, but please just forgive yourself and try better the next minute.
Yeah. And so true, because as much as we should be students of our kids, I think it's also just so important for us to be students of ourselves. I mean, if we find ourselves being triggered time and time again into the red zone by something our kids are doing, we need to be looking at ourselves going like, why is this so triggering for me? And what can I do about it? I mean, in a way, we should have that top-down control more so than our kids do. We're adults.
Theoretically, and if we don't, we should. Yeah. Theoretically, we should. And I love that, Rob. That's the reflection we do with ourselves. Hey, this seems to, and maybe we can talk to our partner about it, or our spouse about it, or a friend about it. Say, you know, can I talk to you about this? When my child does X, I just go through the roof. And I'm kind of curious, and we can become curious, right? And that's all right. Sometimes we get so triggered, and it'll be interesting to find out why, right?
Yeah. I know we're getting close to the end of our time, Mona. I would love to hear what you have to say about children who are neurodiverse, Can you say a few words about how we should think about behaviors? And what do you mean when you talk about children who are neurodiverse?
Sure. I'm beginning to wonder if there is such a thing as neurotypical anymore, really, because I think that, you know, sometimes psychologists use the word neurotypical, meaning the typical person. But in reality, we're all neurodiverse. All of us have our own genetic code. We have the way we were in pregnancy in our mommy's bellies, right? We all have our constitution. We are all neurodiverse. That phrase is often used for children who are diagnosed with differences, brain wiring differences, such as the autism spectrum, which is a very common diagnosis right now anyway, and changing day by day, and may not even be a medical diagnosis in the future. It may just, I think where it's going is that it's going to be a form of neurodiversity that is not considered a disorder by any means, but a profound difference in how people process information. Let's see, children with sensory processing issues. So they may have overreactivity to sounds, to movement, to taste, to smell, could be neurodiverse. And those children often have behavior issues that are misunderstood. So I think of neurodiverse as people who are maybe exhibiting those sorts of reactions to the world that are not as common as others. But we have to have really a lot of compassion for these kiddos. And I'm trying in my own field to have them be not diagnosed with DSM diagnoses, but to have them viewed from the lens of adaptation, from the lens of beyond behaviors, from the polyvagal theory, whereby we understand the adaptive responses of their behaviors. And I'm also touched and I've learned so much from my neurodivergent clients. I have seen some babies when they were like 2 years old, when I had to give them a diagnosis way back then, and now they're in their 20s, and I've seen them blossom and grow. And I shifted in my thinking, because the way I was trained was trying to help children, way back then, right? In the 90s, in the late 80s, we were trained to have children try to look more typical. So we would do behavior management and put them in social skills group to have them look more normal. And all of that, I turned the opposite of all of that, in that helping parents understand that I don't want you or your child to feel like there's anything wrong with them because they have a different brain.
We just had Dr. Barry Prezant on. He wrote a book called Uniquely Human about autism.
Yes. Oh, and, gosh, he's the best. Yeah.
Yeah. It was exactly along those lines as well, right? That, you know, there are a lot of behaviors that are coping mechanisms that we shouldn't suppress them. They're going to cause more stress if we suppress them.
Yes.
And so some things may just be annoying things. We just need to leave them alone. You know, like it doesn't really matter. You know, if a child likes to flap their arms when they're excited, who cares? It's great. You know, that's what they do. And we all do things like that. And I think we need all a little bit more grace in that situation too, to say like, is this really a behavior that we need to suppress or shift into a different direction? Not really.
Oh, I love that. It's just wonderful hearing that from a pediatrician. It's just where we need to go, because mm-hmm. behaviors are automatic adaptations. And it's really kind of cruel to take away something. Think about if a child is told the movement you're making in your body right now, you know, we're going to give you some stickers or some goodies if you stop doing that. We're going to hold something you treasure away from you so that you'll stop adapting to your body's need to move. Mm-hmm. That's not okay.
Yeah, no, exactly. I wish people could just see your reaction there for a second there when you said that statement, because it's true. It's like, that just does not make sense, does it?
I know, I wish you could see my face.
So I think, you know, in this world, we're just seeing things becoming increasingly demanding for kids. Schedules are getting busier. There's more stress. COVID has just wreaked havoc on families in terms of more expectations, less to do. And I think every family is feeling it one way or another. We've already alluded to it a few times in this episode. it looks like the future is indeed more uncertain now than it maybe has ever been. But what gives you hope, Mona, for this coming generation of kids and parents and families? What is giving you hope? What's a bright light on the horizon for you right now?
Oh, I there is such a bright light. I wake up every morning and like so happy to be alive and to be well and to be seeing the positive parenting movement morph and get even better, because there has been a group of parents and professionals who have said, look, we're going to look at things a little different than our parents' generation did. We're going to be positive. We're going to raise humans who are empathic, and we're going to be empathic with them, and we're not going to spank, and we're going to do things differently. And so I see these parents as our leaders, and I'm working kind of alongside them and giving them the neuroscience to say, let's run with this. There's, you know, because parenting educators and parents don't really go out and do RCTs, you know, research controlled trials that provide scientific evidence. But people like Dr. Porges, people like Dan Siegel and Bruce Perry, and people who do study the brain are giving us this joyful, hopeful, huge basket of information that's going to make our children's lives better, and it's going to make them better parents than we were, and we're doing better, I think, every year as new information comes up. I love parents. Parents are heroes. And if you are a parent right now or a grandparent, or even if you're not, you've gotten through this pandemic, you are a hero. And give yourself so much compassion, because our world has never faced life threat every day for almost a year now, like we have. So I'm hopeful.
Mona, this has just been wonderful to have the time to talk to you. And I'm wondering if you can let us know how we can get in touch with you and find out more about your book and your resources.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I'm on Facebook, Mona Delahook PhD, Instagram at Mona Delahook, Twitter is at Mona Delahook. I have a website, it's repetitive, monadelahook.com. My book is Beyond Behaviors. It's available on Amazon and in stores, certain bookstores. And I love interacting with parents. So seems like Instagram is a very popular, quick way for parents, for younger parents, right? To go and look in these little IGTV videos. So, you know, join me. Come on there, ask questions, interact. It's really fun. I'm having a lot of fun with social media, because when I was first trained, social media wasn't really allowed in psychology. So I think this is awesome. I can get to know more people. It's wonderful.
Well, when I was first trained, email was a new thing. So, so there we go.
I never know it. You look young.
Well, thank you. See, you're a positive psychologist, so thanks for saying that. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you today, Mona. Thanks so much for being on our show, and we will hopefully talk again in the future. Thank you.
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you both so much.
Well, thanks everybody for joining us on the episode today with Mona. I learned so much from talking with Mona and reading her books as well. She makes such a great connection between the behavior that we see and how it is really communication. The child is trying to tell us something. And I think once we reframe behavior in that sort of a way, I think it just helps us to really relate differently to our kids in a much more helpful way, rather than punishing or trying to suppress behavior, really trying to listen in and saying, what is my child saying to me and how can I help them? And, you know, whether that's communication through what they're saying or what they're showing with their, you know, physical actions, it all means something. And I think that approach to parenting and listening to our kids is just so super helpful. So I think Mona's information has been really useful, and parents have really found this resonating with them as well.
Yeah, and great news for our parents. Mona is releasing her new book as of March 15th, 2022. It's called Brain Body Parenting: How to Stop Managing Behavior and Start Raising Joyful, Resilient Kids. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think, the next step and a tying together of all the research and work that she's done over so many years. I'm excited about this new resource.
Yeah, me too. And I'm looking forward to reading that. And of course, talking with her, as I mentioned in the intro, on April the 14th. Again, if you're interested in attending that panel with Mona Delahook in the evening, there's a free parents session. Just go to grievingchildren.com and you can register for that as well. So please do join us. Well, thanks again for joining us on the episode today. If you do like the Smart Family Podcast and you've enjoyed this episode, please do go to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you and what you thought about the episodes. And that also brings attention to the podcast to others who may benefit from it as well.
Well, that's all we have today. And I just want to thank you again for taking the time to join us. It's our aim to bring you high quality conversations in the areas of marriage and parenting to help you love being home.